to advertise, email podcast@thisismatchy.com.
Release yourself from order and logic and enter a new place. It's not work. It's not home. Here, no maps have been drawn. No books have been written. Nothing is certain. Everything is possible. Welcome to podcast and chill with Matt G.
I'm assuming this doesn't end well.
Hinda, Marimini, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the leader of One SA, Ntate Moisi Maimane.
Hey. Aloysius. You can't forget Aloysius.
You can't.
Yeah. Yeah, I was about to ask you, are you related to Alostro?
Get relative. Anyone who shares that name is a relative.
Yeah.
No, it's a special name. You know, I grew up Catholic. My grandmother was Catholic. So yeah. There's a saint in the Catholic Church called Saint Aloysius.
Okay.
So my grandmother thought that Otlanda Muruti. And my mother thought Otlanda Musi.
Yeah.
So I had Musi Aloysius my man.
Were you raised by a grandmother? Because you know every black kid has been raised by the grandmother.
Of course. You know my grandmother, when you say you was raised, you would go there the first day of school holidays.
Yeah.
And when you get there, you know you have a mandatory haircut, le castor oil. That's the combination. So once I was raised, I had fair haircuts and enough castor oil to last me my life. So my grandmother is too special to me. She
so
really...
No, what was Spaita? They used to Spaiti.
Spaita's like if
it's either Spaita or castor oil, one of the two.
Yeah, it's either that.
Yeah.
You gotta pick. But my grandmother is too... She passed away a number of years ago. She probably is the one of the few single influencers in my life. Just totally brought me values. You need a praying grandmother. You need a grandmother who will call you out.
Mm.
You need someone who will say to you, this is the way. And she, you could do many things. You could do wrong things.
Yeah.
But if you didn't go to church, my grandmother would deal with you. That would mean, Jorge, que casta o el espe. So,
did you get hidings?
You know, I grew up koka sigotopsi. And it was more the exception if you didn't get a hiding. Mm. I was the first born in my family. And so, thinking about it, you know, the standards are tested with you. I'm a parent myself, and I can see how, with my daughter, my eldest daughter, umatlali straight. The more they come, I feel like you're a little bit more tired, so you become a lot more lenient about things. But the first ones, you try everything. But my mother is also left-handed.
Yeah.
So no say it's or which side is it coming? She's like a southpaw, so she would like deliver proper hiding.
Yeah.
So I was raised by a Xhosa woman, man. My mother gay. So we don't mess around.
Yeah. Do you remember the last time you got a hiding?
You are out of order. You are disciplined.
What did you get a hiding for the last time that you remember?
It's quite a bad story.
You gotta tell us the story.
Yeah, man.
It's I was in my teenage years and I thought to myself, I'd heard someone say, we must smoke grass.
Hey.
And I didn't know what they meant.
Yeah.
And so we'd mowed the lawn, so there was this grass dried out. So I took it, now I rolled it up. I thought, give my
actual tita. Grass, not actual grass.
Not weed. So
whoa.
Actual grass, I smoked the thing, my mouth swelled up. You know when you come home, maronwetsan, and they started. And literally, I was sick and also properly hammered. So that was the last time. I thought, I'll never do that again. And I'm grateful for that grass experience because it stopped me from doing other things in a community where drugs were like generally readily available, especially marijuana.
So you've never smoked weed?
No.
He gets PTSD.
No. I had uncles who were a little bit older than me who were a little bit like that. Glue was their thing.
Yeah.
Ooh. And from time to time, you know that Kenya Tropica, they would say try it and see what happens. But I'm grateful. You know, my life has been guided by the divine. And I'm grateful, Jorge, we had moments where things could have gone badly, man. Mm. Like, I speak to enough young people who just that one hit of something gets them hooked onto something over a long period of time.
Mm.
I was grateful. I played sport as a junior. I played...
Yeah, you wanted to be a soccer player.
Whoa.
You know, so we had our soccer team, and that kept me kind of focused. I knew you couldn't you couldn't really perform well if you were high or something. So that helped me out a lot. And I think I'm grateful. I genuinely count my blessings. And sometimes we think of the things we get, but we forget the things we were spared from.
100%, right?
So like not being able to be hooked on drugs. I mean, we grew up in communities, Shebeens, where the order of the day, I mean, apartheid set it up that way. So I'm grateful I never got into like heavy drinking or alcohol or any of that. And thanks to my grandmother and my parents, they had a value for education that insisted that whenever you must get to school and you must get through it. So,
yeah, man, he's got like 10 degrees, dog.
Dude, from Wales all over, man.
But before we get to your education, how long did you stay at Krugersdorp for? Because that's where you were born.
Well, I was born in Kolleratong, which is just outside Kagiso,
Kotopsi.
So that's the, I suppose, the association. I lived Kosoweto all my life. And my parents still live in the same house. So I'm grateful. There's Soweto in the 80s was probably one of the most beautiful upbringings any child could ever wish for. You know, when I think about the freedoms we enjoyed in a very oppressed system, Soweto gave you the contrast of both. It gave you the right to play football in the streets without, as a child, worrying about other issues. But it also reminded you of the broader struggle. I didn't live far from a hostel, so violence was like, you know, part of the thing. I mean, we learned how to make a petrol bomb before you knew how to ride a bicycle. So the combination between those two things made the contrast in Soweto so... You had rich. To grow up fast. You had to grow up fast, but you also were free. I don't know how to put that. It was like the contrast of Soweto. You could listen to... My father loved music, so Neraldi LP.
You
know, if you know LPs, you know 45. Babu, I got a USB. So we listened to a lot of music. I grew up listening to a lot of jazz. I grew up with bands like Bo Ray Chikapapiri was a regular at my house. Tapelo Komu, who was their producer, was a family friend. So I grew up in this camouflage of music and jazz and all of that. And at the same time, in a broader story of apartheid, the violence, but also in my high school years, part of the one and a half-ism.
Yeah.
I call it that because here we were living Kokasi, but going to these ex-Model C schools, interacting in a new kind of way, you know, how fitla, when your assignment is handwritten, babang, it's typed.
It's typed, yeah.
It's just after 94, so you've got white people, you've got the dynamic. I remember race wars in high school. Like, there was only 9 of us in the school, and I remember some kid saying something about my mother. I took the chair, I'm a black semi, you know, and it became like the fight in the classroom.
Wow.
So that was the contrast that we lived in. And I think sometimes the reason there's an emphasis on the contrast issue is because we must also be honest when we reflect on our history.
Yeah.
Not all white people were oppressors. We lived in a world that was one and a half.
Mm.
And yeah, there were some racists. I know that for a fact. But I also know there were white people who helped pay for my school blazer when I didn't have one.
Yeah.
Who said, we'll give you some money. We'll help you. They helped me fund my education. They helped me get through school.
Because I was shocked when I found out that you grew up in Soweto. I thought he was like a North boy, like soft life.
Yeah,
now
when
he
speaks, that's
what
you think. Yeah. Ay, topsi. In fact, as I came in here today, the lady who walked me in, Kwako Long Till. Now if you know Long Till, you know Dobsonville. You know, really, there are places in Soweto you know, and Long Till is one of them. And that's where I grew up, and yeah.
You went to Ellen Glen High School,
in the West.
Mm. I heard you're a ladies' man there.
From who?
Yeah, from the ladies that I know.
You know the wrong ones. No. You know, people don't know this about me often. People think, you're in public life, you're an extrovert, you're all of those things. I'm actually very shy.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
It's hard to fathom, right?
People never believe it,
I feel like energy and people, really, I have to work hard. And I had bad skin when I was in high school. So, you know, when others were talking about QTQ, I was very sympathetic to the argument. I could listen to it all the time. So I was always like, approaching girls, I was quite.
So how do you meet your
quite
wife?
Quite daunting.
Then? How do you meet your wife if you're so shy?
My wife and I went to church together.
Okay.
So that helped. And secondly, I think she needed a BE partner. I'm joking. No. We were very good friends for a long time. And I even think in trying to ask her out, you know, hey, I had to give a speech, man. And I panicked. I eventually was explaining to her, you know, if you're a cricketer and then you want to hit the ball, you need this one to field it here. Let's create the partnership. And she was like, you want to go out? I was like, cool. Let's do that. That makes it easy. And since she's been my best friend, we've been married now for 16 years.
Wow.
We've got three kids.
That's amazing, man.
So, yeah, I'm grateful. She's amazing. She's smart.
How do you tell your parents?
Ooh, Jesus. Yeah.
Because you bring home a white lady, they're like, yo, which one is this?
That's the other thing. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I didn't bring a lot of girls home.
Yeah.
And when I brought her home, I had to do preparations, you know? Mm. Because sometimes we forget that as a country, racism has got two dynamics to it. It's got power and superiority, but it's also got inferiority. Mm. And I remember speaking to her in the car, saying to her, Bon, we're going to get to my parents' house. My mother is the most hospitable person you'll meet. She'll be the first one to offer you coffee or tea.
Wow.
When we get there, remember you are arriving. Mm. You've got power by virtue of your history and the color of your skin. Mm. You need to break that down when you get there. Mm. Because when you get there, I'm going to ask you to make the tea yourself and offer it to my mother.
Yeah.
Because she needs to realize that at the end of the day, you are her daughter. You're not any other thing. If this thing goes anywhere, that's what it's going to be.
Yes. And it's African tradition.
Absolutely. And I wanted her to get that up front. So arriving home, it became that interaction. I was grateful we had that chat because I'll never, ever forget. We were at a funeral of one of the cousins, and we were standing in a long line, as one does Kokasi after go gravesite. And as we're standing in the line, she was standing in front of me, now she is, and my grandmother came and said, sorry, my dear, in our culture, the women are over there, ba pila. I'm sorry, my darling. And you know what? I was grateful for that experience. Why? Because it told me khore, suddenly she was another Magodi in the Maimani family. Mm. She wasn't white. She wasn't any of that. She was just another. And she herself, that's one of the things I truly love about my wife, is that she's conscious about, hey, I understand my own background, but I also understand the South African context, and we're trying to raise South African adults. So,
100%, yeah.
She learns Setswana, she has to learn, she works through that, and she's an advocate for a very diverse society. So I'm grateful. I truly
and when you go to her family, when you meet the in-laws, is it the same?
It wasn't always in the beginning.
Yeah.
Remember, all of us were at church together.
Okay, yes, yeah.
And to be honest with you, when we were getting engaged, about to get married, we had a lot of extended family from her side who were like, this thing is wrong. Mm. Now, that's the other side of power.
Sure.
Because people were like, hey, what went wrong? Are you pregnant? She was like, no, I just love this guy. They were like, are you sure? Like, this thing is not right. We had people pulling away from our wedding. We invited them. They said, we are not coming because we think this thing is wrong. And that's where faith makes a big difference, because we thought, even though we can identify that this is a fairly discriminatory act, it's racism, but we can't adopt that attitude, because people sometimes aren't, they start off fearful before they become racist. Mm. And you've got to arrest it at the fear, because what we don't know, we shy away from. Mm. I will sometimes think, when I look at some of the incidents in our country, it's because we don't know each other, we fear each other. Mm. And so immediately we kind of go, ah, it's racist. Mm, mm. But I've got to believe, Jorge, sometimes people don't know, they're fearful, and you've got to help them transition. You've got to help them say, eh, don't fear me, I'm a fellow human being. Give ubuntu. Mm. Because when you do that, there's hope for people to change. Mm. I think the racist, the classic racist, is a person who, once you confront them to say, hey, that action, that step there was wrong, and then they remain in that position saying, knowing it is wrong, I'm not going to change. Mm. That is, for me, the racist. But when someone, because how many of us, let's speak as guys, how many of us have said things maybe sometimes about women?
Yeah.
And you needed a lot of things. You know what I mean? You needed a woman to come to you and say, brother.
You don't say that.
And check you. And check you.
Yeah.
Does that make you sexist? Now we say you are sexist, you are finished. No. Sometimes you stop and you say, you're right.
100%.
I was wrong. I need a take two on that issue.
But don't put a label on it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the hope of humanity.
100%.
But if we don't believe human beings are able to change, then the project is doomed. Then we must assume we're done.
Do you think Helen Ziller's racist?
I think Helen Ziller says some very racist things, in my view.
Yeah.
I have worked with Helen. Mm. I respect her. I think she says some things that can be deemed as that. But I think, to me, at the end of the day, part of the journey is about challenging.
100%.
It's about challenging the issues. So like, I thought the statement about colonialism, for example, was one of those statements that were discriminatory against people. I thought that the statement was it undermined the pain of black people, but it also undermined the pain of Afrikaans people.
Mm.
Because colonialism also delivered concentration camps for Afrikaners.
Mm. Is it?
Sure. And that's another untold story. Mm. And I thought that was discriminatory.
Mm. Mm.
So I challenged that.
Yeah.
And I think if she took the position that said no, she could retract or she could do whatever.
Mm.
And I still give her the space to say, you need to work this thing out.
Mm.
But I think broader, I wouldn't class her in that way.
Yeah.
I would simply say she says some things that I think are discriminatory.
Yeah.
And are hurtful sometimes to people who look like me.
Before you got into politics, what were you doing?
A lot.
Yeah.
I was in business. Yeah. I was in church.
You're a lecturer as well?
Yeah, I lectured. And I did, so I did a couple of things, yeah.
Mm, but not like waitressing jobs, nothing.
Hey man, my first job was working at Total Sports.
No way.
I used to sell shoes. I used to sell shoes. I used to...
What a good sport, eh?
Yeah. No.
I totally agree.
I didn't have a lot of...
shoes.
Money. And I didn't have... Remember, when I finished school, my mother worked as a cashier.
Yeah.
And my father worked in a factory. There was no ways they were going to afford to take me to university.
Mm. Mm.
And we needed to work hard for them to get me there. And I needed to work hard to get myself through it.
Yeah.
So that took a lot of work, and I had to hustle like everybody else.
Yeah.
Had to hustle. I worked every Saturday. I spent more money on transport getting there than actually making money. But I'm grateful for that experience. And
yeah.
What made you study theology, man?
One, I have a deep faith as a Christian. It's why, and I want to circle back to this issue about Helen, because I think it's an important one, certainly for here. I happen to believe that human beings are redeemable. I happen to believe that people can change unless they choose themselves not to change.
Mm.
And I will keep calling even people like Helen, whoever, it doesn't matter who, to rise up to being South Africans who can contribute to the dream. And along the journey, we may get it wrong, but we need to call people out.
Mm.
And we need to call ourselves to greatness.
Yeah.
Because I think the conversation isn't aided when we say, we are done. It's only when a person chooses to say, nah, I'm done.
Mm.
I'm exiting the South African story. I'm going to sit in a corner. Then we have to deal with that issue. And I think it's important to put that on the table. Not for any other reason other than the fact that if anyone is listening out to this podcast, I want them to know I invite people to greatness about this country. That's the country I want to build. Now you say, why do I study theology?
How long did you practice that speech?
Yeah. The mirror knows it maybe 100 times at home, eh?
Because you just had to quiet it.
Thank you for that question, Saul.
Yeah, what's today? Whatever day it is, but this one I'm telling you.
Nothing like that. I think it's important. You know, leadership, Michelle Obama says it best. When they go low, you've got to keep going high.
Yeah.
And it's important. And I think why I studied theology is because I studied theology and psychology at the same time. Because I was trying to figure out that what makes us human? And what is our relationship to the divine? And I'm grateful I did that because it let me see a person for who they are. It let me look at you and go, I think, Jorge, you are part. When I see you, I see a fellow human being. You make me more human, but I also see the divine in you. And whatever your gender is, whatever your orientation is, whatever, I see the divine in you. And that for me has become important. And
what did you learn about humans from studying psychology and theology?
We are all flawed.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that's important. And I also do think that we all have a... You know what distinguishes a human being from an animal or whatever? Is that we seek to find meaning and purpose. And yes, those things are crucial. Because a life well lived is a life that expresses its fullness of its purpose.
Woo!
Once that purpose is extracted, then life can't just be reducing to inhaling and exhaling. I just think there's more to it. We've always got to articulate the why.
Happiness is in the purpose.
Absolutely. Find that, you fulfill your life in a way that you can ride above the storm. It's what gives you the why. It's what makes you get up in the morning. It's what makes you... 100%. It's what lets a musician know that it's not just about writing lyrics, but it's about doing something greater. Mm. So to me, that's what makes us who we are. And I guess if one of my favorite verses, that all of creation reveals his glory. And to me, that reminds me that it doesn't matter what you do, whether you're an artist, whether you're a politician, whether you're a whatever, just reveal something great.
Wow.
Just you're built from great substance, do that.
Yeah.
And that gives me hope. You know, I've traveled all over the world. I've seen some atrocious things. I've met some atrocious people. But I've got to keep hope alive. I've got to keep believing that human beings... It's not the worship of human beings, but it's that once human beings find a purpose, they can be great.
Is that why you got into politics?
Totally.
Yeah.
Because politics is an ugly game, right?
Yeah, it's a mafia business. Yeah, man. I don't know how you guys do
it's
it.
It's an ugly game.
Hey.
I had young kids when the campaign heats up and you're away from kids. It's not always healthy for family. It's not... alcohol is cheap in parliament. they won't tell you that, but that's the truth.
Whoa!
It's a lot of things, you know. It's a lot of things, but again, I didn't find being in parliament that different to my own sense of expression of purpose. I didn't find it. For me, there are three things I exist to do. I think I want to rebuild this country because I genuinely believe we have a great nation.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful country. Especially Cape Town. He's from Cape Town.
Cape Town it depends which Cape Town. But all of it is. Our country is beautiful. If you go to Mpumalanga, it's a beautiful place.
Most beautiful.
You go to KZN.
Yeah.
So there's a rebuild formation that comes out of what I look to do. There's a renewal sense of going, can we help people find their true purpose? And ultimately, I want to serve this country to the best that I can, that we build a nation that prospers for everybody. Now, if you find that, it doesn't matter whether you're president or pauper. It doesn't matter whether you're business or whatever. I've done enough diverse things, but the why is always the same. Mm. We don't invest in businesses that harm people. Mm. We invest in businesses that build great people. We don't get involved politically. So when I got into politics, I'll tell you this, man. I was Kozansprayed. I'll never forget this. I went to go visit this woman. I was sitting with her. I said, "Mama, what are you doing?" She says, "No, I'm digging this thing in the toilet in the garden." I said, "When's I'm doing, Mom?" She said, "No, I'm building my own toilet." And then I thought, where is the dignity in that woman when she's building her own toilet in democratic South Africa? Mm. Is that poverty? One of the things that poverty does is that it robs people of their dignity. Oh, yes. Once you've lost your dignity is synonymous to your humanity. Mm. I can take away everything, but I can't take away your dignity. Mm. What apartheid did is that it insulted and dethroned the dignity of human beings. The task that we've got to do, that's why in our constitution, the values begin with dignity. That's why today, the job that we've got to do is build dignity. That's why when people make statements, regardless of where that statement comes from, I always wonder, don't impugn the dignity of somebody. When somebody says, "No, but we provide water, we do this, but the dignity of people is secondary," I go, that's wrong. The dignity is fundamental. My humanity, botobaka, is fundamental to what I do. That's why I have a problem with those who are corrupt. Because I think, how can you steal from the people, arrive in the X5 you bought from the proceeds of stealing from those people and attend their funeral of their child who died because you didn't build the drains where those children were supposed to, where the sewage system was supposed to work from. Mm. That, to me, is undermining the dignity of people. So I've never shied away from the notion that my spirituality, my own value set, is something that helps me guide what we do politically.
Where do you think corruption stems from?
To me, I hate to sound preachy, but it starts with incompetence. When people don't know what they're supposed to do, they can become corrupt. Mm. Because, I mean, when you want to try and tell me what a swimming pool is a fire pool, like genuinely, like, come on. Don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
When a website is 140 million rand, don't do that. So there's a dynamic of incompetence and an incompetent state. I sometimes think we don't have a corruption problem. We have a competence problem. Mm. In this sense, if I take my iPad, I put it on the table, and then I leave. If one of the comrades here needs an iPad and takes it, it's not their fault. Mm. They need it, they took it.
Mm.
And if I have the incapability of arresting them post facto, then who's the problem exactly?
Mm.
So the first one is incompetence. The second one, I think, is the lack of transparency. That's what feeds corruption. So when decision making is done only by you, so if only one person at the Home Affairs can decide who gets an ID, that person is bound to be corrupt because they have extraordinary power that other people don't have. Let's keep everything transparent. And then the last thing I would argue the case is that actually the system becomes corrupted when people lose the purpose of money. If you say to me, "I give you R1 billion and you don't know what to do with that R1 billion or to deploy it or to use it properly, you end up thinking it's for your personal use because it's money available. So we've got to reform the state to say, we mustn't just be offended at corruption that it benefits a few. We must be offended at corruption because of the opportunity cost that corruption does. When people are corrupt and children don't have a school, it's not only that they stole that money. It's that now we've got kids who are sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah.
I nearly said fuck all, but I'm not sure if I'm okay to say that.
Like
they're sitting here. You know what I mean? It's just, and it makes me angry. Like think about the floods in KZN.
Mm.
It's a human disaster. It's a natural disaster. I get that. But how many bridges were substandard? How many drainage systems were not done? Because the government is incompetent. Now people die.
Mm.
Why do we sit around and tolerate that?
Mm.
It is unacceptable. And that's the opportunity cost of corruption. Young people are unemployed today. You know, if we were growing in the last 10 years at the same rate as other developing economies, today we would have 23 million people employed as opposed to 14 million people.
Huh.
Now that's the opportunity cost. The line of unemployment starts, if people, you said to people, "Ka social distance, you will line up one next to each other, all the unemployed. It would start in Cape Town, it would finish in Cairo.
Yo!
Let's
yo.
Place that image in context.
But with all this knowledge, why didn't you do this when you're in the DA?
It's a good question. You know what I think, actually? I think it's an unfair statement.
Yeah.
Because I think I said a lot of things.
Yeah.
I fought for a lot of things.
Sure.
But I think sometimes people look at the rapping of the DA and they say, I don't hear some of those things because of where they're coming from.
Mm.
I always fought for equity.
Mm.
And I worked hard for it.
Mm.
In fact, against even the DA's own caucus, I was the first one to say more than half of our members of parliament need to be people of color.
Yeah.
I always fought for that. I always fought for ideals around education. And I said, well, you can't build multiple cities. You've got to build one city. I always fought for an economy that works.
Mm.
I think sometimes people don't hear you. Just like when you go to your doctor who's wearing a white coat, you're not expecting philosophy, you're expecting health.
100%.
So sometimes I think when you wear like kind of like a DA cloak, people kind of look at you and they go, Waringa DA. And sometimes here's the problem. One of the greatest difficulties is that every time I'd arrive at an interview, someone would sit back and say, Helen, how is Helen Zille? And that's what you want to talk about? Like, or like, yeah. Oh, Ruth Wheeler got this one or that one, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the problem with that is that we reduce our problems to personalities and fail to really interrogate. I can promise you now, none of us sitting here know what the president's ideas are.
Yeah.
But instead we want to ask him, is Zweli going to win? So the problem with politics is that it focuses on intra-politics and it forces people to be engaged in fights. That's why I don't have time for the DA in that sense. I don't have time for any other. I'm saying, let's talk about South Africa. Let's talk about unemployment. Let's talk about, you know, crime. Let me take crime as an example.
Mm.
Again, here's an image to remember. If I lined up all the coffins of the people who have been murdered since 1994, they would start in Joburg and finish in Cape Town.
Sure. Damn it.
The murder rate in this country, we don't talk about it enough.
Mm.
We really don't. Yet people are being murdered. People.
Yeah, it takes like traveling to other countries like Botswana, Mozambique, we were at Swaziland.
Yeah.
And when they talk about crime, they're like, yo, they're scared to come to SA because of like the stuff they see. It's not normal in their country.
And these are things that when we look at what the real problems of this country is, we must to me, it's all about jobs. We've got to bunker down and say, is what we're doing helping us build jobs or not?
Mm.
Is what we're doing, yeah. We got to focus on that. We got to say to ourselves, is the education of our kids where it's at? You know, I mean, let me be frank.
Mm.
A child who grows up in Soweto today and a child who grows up in Stellenbosch, their prospects are exactly the same as they were pre-1994.
Huh.
That's something that's wrong,
mm.
right? So we've got to make it such that if everybody works hard, and I can't, it will get rewarded.
Mm.
I think one of the most difficult things is that we got too many people hustling, but it never gets rewarded sometimes. Mm. You can run a great gig, whatever the gig is.
Mm.
Ah, stogo togo. The comrades get favored.
Mm. Mm.
That shouldn't happen. So I want to build a state. That's why I'm here. So you say I rehearse, whatever. The truth is, this is the stuff that I lie in bed at night going, we must fix South Africa.
What do you think about what Ntata Lux is doing, Operation Dudula?
Brother, I won't lie to you, man. Immigration is a very important issue, okay? You've got to have controlled immigration, which means that you must make sure it's possible for anyone who comes into this country to be properly registered and for them to claim the status that they need legally. Okay? It doesn't start inside the country. It starts at the border. Inside the country is a different conversation, and that's why I have a problem with what's going on.
Mm.
I have a problem with that because you can't go around reducing South Africa's problems to the problems of immigrants. I have a problem with that. I have a problem for a number of reasons. One, to back to the earlier part of this conversation, I grew up Kokasi, where in Soweto, I can remember the violence between Zulus and everyone else in some instances, that we used to have that from hostels. You had to learn how to speak as a Zulu. I struggle when someone arrives in Deep Sluat and says, Info, count in a language that's African, and oh, that's South African. If you can't, you are an immigrant. We're going to deal with
what's
you.
This?
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Hey, they would have killed me, man. Hey.
You know what I mean? So you are endangering your own citizens.
Yeah.
Secondly, the pain is job creation. People want work. But you can't say jobs are now stolen by immigrants whilst there's a government that's failed. Lastly, you got to get back to dealing with dictators in Swaziland, in Zimbabwe, and say to those people, hey, you can't carry on like this. Because that must be a point at which you can't say, we'll open our borders for everybody, but you don't deal with the dictators who are forcing people to leave their country. Mm. Immigration is a global phenomenon. My problem with what some of the Operation Dudula is doing is that it is hating on fellow Africans. And I have a problem with that. You see, I can invite you to my house, brother. We have a great dinner. We eat, it's nice, we have a good time. And then my wife says something, Begumure. And then I give her a backhand and then I hit her. Do you sit at the dinner and go, the dinner was nice, that's just a small issue of domestic violence? Or do you say, Mfo, if you hit anyone, the whole thing is a problem. Once you go out of your way to hate fellow Africans, you not only you create self-hatred. And furthermore, you lose the actual conversation about migration. You actually enter into a space that I think undermines the sense of self. So to me, let's work out policies that deal with migration. Let's deal with borders. Let's ensure that I'm understanding. We don't want little Lagos or little this place. We don't want that. We want societies that work. But let's make sure that actually we address the issues that we face, whether those are employment, healthcare, access, etc. Let's focus on the government, because the ANC would love nothing more than having people who go out and say, our problems are because of immigrants. Because guess what the ANC does? It sits back and says, Weabon, let them fight there. See, now we can carry on with our business here, whilst in fact the country is being mismanaged, misgoverned. If you reduce all our problems on immigrants, you've missed the point.
You wake up, you're president of South Africa tomorrow. What are you changing?
Firstly, the state.
Yeah.
We have a hollowed out state. I mean, what does the Minister of Small Businesses do every day? What does the Minister of Comms do every day? How do you interact with government? Doing an incredible thing here. How do you interact? Does government help you? Is it on your side?
I don't even think they know where.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
You know what I mean? So fix it. Fix it. Fix it is all I'm trying to say. Let's build a capable state that is able to deliver on certain things. Because any program you adopt from that point requires the capability of the government. You and I must try, boss. If we leave here, we can go to any Home Affairs here, try and get an ID. Dololo. You'll spend the whole day, 2 days. That's economically not being productive in a system that can be digitized, helpful. So let's fix the state. And I think that's one of the things that is crucial. The second thing is, it's about jobs, stupid, to Clinton's campaign. Let's do everything that fixes our economy. And for me, one of the things that's crucial is redirect your spending towards economic efficiency so that micro-enterprise can thrive. Let's help people, let's make it easier for people to employ. Let's make it easier for micro small businesses to happen. so that you can, you know, in economies our size, 80% of the businesses employ between 10 to 20 people.
Sure.
Whereas in this country, we're so obsessed with all of these big businesses and we're hoping for thousands and thousands. Yes. No, actually, let's help thousands of people who hire fewer people.
Oh, I get you.
You know what
yes,
I mean? So let's
yes.
do that. And then let's change this 30% pass rate business. I know I've been like being hammered. No, you can pass at more. No, no. Which child must pass at 30%?
Yeah.
Would you, if I got you into an Uber now,
yeah,
and the Uber driver says, brother, I only know 30% of the road signs. Are you in there? Like, are you like going, yes, we can. Right? Like, I'm like, So the truth is, we got to fix our education system, not only from changing the pass rate point of view, but ensuring that actually we've got teachers who do full days of teaching, making sure learners actually can read and write by the age of 10. So that's fixing ECD, making sure that our math, science, technology, and English, so the STEM subjects, we help those kids be able to succeed in that regard. Because if we don't focus on that, we are not only robbing kids of jobs of today, we're robbing them of jobs of the future. Yeah. Because what you guys are doing here now, when I was at school, no one told me I could host a podcast.
Mm, mm.
Was never thought of.
It didn't exist.
But you know how to work a Mac, you know how to do recording. These guys are doing sound engineering. They're doing all sorts of things. These are new jobs. And I'm saying, well, what's coming next? What's coming next? And how do we help young people participate in that economy? Let's focus on that. I can go through another things, but those for me. And then lastly, obviously, I've lamented a lot about the safety of this country. And one of the things I'm very keen to do is to say, let's stop having a national SAPS, because SAPS at a national level means that when you go to a police station, the accountability isn't lowest to the ground, which means someone can bribe the cop or someone can make your file disappear, all of those things. Let's decentralize the police, merge them with Metro, so that how it's Otsi and you cause kak in the city, we can lock you up.
Yeah.
Right? I think those for me would be priorities that we'd focus on. Because in a safe country with educated people and an economy that's growing, I think we've got the basis to really move South Africa forward.
You know what my thing is with politics? I hate politics, man. Because there's so many people like yourself and other politicians who have great ideas, dog. Mm. But once they get in there, nothing ever changes. It's like, what's the point? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, nothing ever changes, bro.
Nothing.
Like, if you get in there tomorrow,
yeah.
would you implement any change?
Of course.
Would you not eat? Yeah. With all that power. They always get them eat.
If all, you know what I mean?
Essentially.
Essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And citizens are correct to be annoyed about that. You should be. You are right. You're right to call out the stuff about politicians not actually doing what they're meant to do. But imagine if you got in and you had the fear of getting out soon. Because when I talk about electoral reform, the reason why politicians get in and eat is because they don't fear the voter.
They're comfortable.
You know what I mean? They're not scared of you. They're not scared that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and say, hi, Moose, we gave you 3 years or we gave you 2 years. Because change doesn't, you know, doesn't, it's not like this. But let's say we give you 2-3 years. In the 3 years, we say, Moose, you're not doing anything, boss. We're going to move a motion for you to be removed. As citizens, we can do that. And then I would be recalled by the citizens. Now, that's why direct elections are important. Because at this point in time, we all vote for a party, and then the party deploys who they like, and then after 5 years, they come back to you with a food parcel, and then you go, oh, great, let's start again, let's vote again. But what I'm saying is, let's invert the triangle. Let's not put politicians at the top, let's put citizens at the top, and make sure people can account. Because at this point in time, no one accounts to anybody.
So
to your point, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Politics is messed up, man. Yeah. I get it. The reason I walked out of parliament wasn't the DA in many ways.
Because
I said to President Ramaphosa, I said, Chief, there are people out there, you're not talking to them, you're not talking about them.
Yeah.
When the next time they come here, they're going to set this place on fire.
Mm.
And the riots in July last year were exactly 100%. About that.
Yeah, it was
people going, we want to show you that we want our power back. Mm. For right or wrong reasons. You can debate the issue after that. But so what I'm trying to get at is, when it's said and done, you got to force me to listen to you not you listen to me. And we must pass laws that make it possible for me to hold you accountable, to make sure that actually when it's said and done, there's nothing I do that doesn't fear you. Because in other democracies, you screw up, people vote you out. In this country, you screw up, you get promoted. That's a problem.
I think as it's point, like when I look at all the parties, there's just too many parties out there. And, you know, you've got your organization, Herman Mashaba's got his own thing going on. To me, it feels like everybody's just fighting for a seat. And like you say, you're going to run in the next elections. But this, it feels like ANC, DA won't even feel anything a dent because all the other votes just spread amongst all your small parties.
That's a good question. I think one of the things that we've got to do is make it less and make the people who agree work together so that we can make a bigger alternative. But here's the proof point. To me, I'm saying I'm not trying to build another bus. I'm trying to build Uber. And by that, I mean, let's put candidates who come from communities who you can dictate to what they want to do so that they can represent you in parliament. That's what I'm trying to do. So it's not like just simply going around going, let's just start another party for a party's sake. Let's create a movement. If I can say to young people, even in this room, guys, this is your country. All we need is 3.5 million votes to bring about the change. Because yes, politics doesn't always deliver on everything, but change has its own dividends. And we've got to change the system. So let Uber compete, but we've got to ensure that communities are at the top, because when we do that, we stop having too many parties. We actually have leaders in communities. Boss, the riots last year, which leader went to the community and said, "Hey, Batum, calm down."
Figile Mbalula came.
Figile. Chabulani Mall, we saw him.
Yeah,
we were there. He was in what capacity?
Well, you could tell you was told to go there.
Exactly. Me, I'm saying, let the person who was elected from Soweto be there.
Yeah.
Because once Charlotte Maxeke just burned down the road. Charlotte Maxeke. Who said anything? Who's accountable for that? But here's the problem. You've got a hospital that is no longer working, at least is overflowing in capacity, but no one is saying anything. So all I'm saying to you is, this is our country. Don't feel like you are disempowered. Get back and let's collectively together say, let's do what we need to do.
What do you think about the role of like white monopoly capital? What's your take on
this? It's a challenge. It's a challenge. I think the sentiment you are referring to is when an economy is locked in a few hands. Okay. I've set up a social impact fund precisely because we're trying to break monopolism. And we've got to ensure that you can't, the easiest way I can say it is, let's not allow that person who owns the restaurant to also own the distribution company that delivers the food to the restaurant and the farm that makes the food at the restaurant. The value chain is, so let's create industries that can compete in that. Let's make sure that, I'm strong on equity.
Yeah,
I think participation is the issue in that, let's reset. So like, there are a couple of things that for a short-term intervention, I've asked for a national venture capital fund so that black businesses can benefit from that and participate in the economy. And the second thing that I've said is, look, if your parents didn't go to university, let the state fund your university. Because if we do that, let's get you involved, because that is a clear demonstration of the fact that we're trying to change. And then even on the farming thing, man, I've been thinking a lot about how we do it. And one of the things I've been trying to think is, if you're a black farmer, we must give you cheap finance or easier finance to access. For white farmers, they must go and compete for market share in market like anyone else would. Yeah. But what we then do is, if you're a partnership between those two things, you can qualify in a medium scale so that we can actually break down the fact that we want more people to participate. That's what we want to do.
Musa Maimane, sorry, man, you got to go because like, we only have you for 40, 45 minutes.
Oh, snap.
He's got to catch a plane. But you can't leave before I ask you this because it's a very important question.
Kaiser Chiefs.
No.
Oh,
Kosi for life.
Do you like Shimza's new single?
spinning the turntables.
Oh, Shims!
Shims are drum, the new singer. Do you like it?
Yes.
No, I don't. He spins the turntables, that one. No.
What music are you listening to? Who do you listen to?
Right now, I listen to a whole range. Yeah. I'm just starting to get back into a lot of kind of like Afro jazz.
Okay.
So I'm starting to hang back into that, harking back.
Yeah.
I went through a whole thing about rap, so yeah. I was listening to it a little bit.
Who are you listening to?
I listen to different things. I mean, remember now we grew up on Tupac.
Yeah.
Right?
Biggie.
So people like, I suppose part of what Drake and the team are doing, that's super. But now I'm literally, if you were to check my iPod now.
iPod?
Good generational thing. But
bro,
iMusic.
Hey, man. How old are you?
Give me all, dude. Man, I got an iPhone on my tongue. I had the first one of the first one.
I listen to a whole genre of things. And then I'll close with this. Because this is the sad bit. You'll never know.
Yeah.
Your phone becomes the entity of your kids. So I have to listen to Sing.
Yeah.
Sing, all that music from Sing 2. So that's great.
So you don't listen to any local rappers like Black Heat, Nasty C, those
I try, but I must be honest, on another scale, I do listen, but not enough. I'll be fair enough because in truth, I read a lot.
Mm.
I listen to a lot of audibles.
What are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading a book called Exodus by Paul Collier, which is about immigration and immigration laws. But I read 4 or 5 books at the same time. So,
jeez.
No, you have to keep going because I get bored. But all of us do it with other medium. Mm. I mean, you watch television. You don't watch just one channel. And then you switch to sport. You like got all things going on. I find the same with books. Sure. So I listen to Paul Collier. I listen to Three Big Economies. Wow. I listen to Think Like a King, a book written by a friend of mine. And then I'm busy working on my own book.
Yeah, nice.
So there's a lot of that kind of work happening. Yeah. And then, so I'll try and read a fair balance. So some policy stuff. I'm working on O Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon.
Wow.
So it's a like I read. I like I read.
Yeah. That's
what. So I read, listen to a bit of music, and then tweet what I like.
What's your book about? About yourself?
Yeah, it's called Believe in Tomorrow. And it really is about this country, where it's gonna go. And maybe you wanna find out a little bit more about the disappointing alliance.
Ooh.
DA.
So you're coming back before you drop the book. No, you gotta come back.
Anytime. It's a great privilege and a pleasure to be here. I respect what you guys do.
Thank you so much, man.
I want you to do well.
If you were like in government, how would you interact with this podcast? Because it asks if government is doing anything with us or for us.
Well, firstly, I think everyone. So if President Maimane was here, I'd make sure that every time you want to gain access to any minister in government, they must be here.
Oh, wow.
And that's it. Why is that? Why is that important? Because you can't hide from the people. Mm. Pitch. You might ask me, you're going to ask me difficult questions. You'll ask me about this one, ask me about that one. That's okay. Mm. But I'm a public representative. I don't represent myself. Come and take me apart.
Yeah, and bring the money. We need the money.
Oh, the money, yeah. We need the bags.
Nah, Zong.
Hey, man. We are here. Podcast in jail. Boom. Thank you so much, Mr. Maimane. Thank you.
Superstar, man.
Thank you. Alostro.
Ramosi. Alostro. Someone is here. They want to know.
I got to bounce.
Yes, thank you so much. That was amazing. We could have done 2 hours easy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
There are so many other questions.
So many go, yeah. So
but I'll come for take two.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you get a picture quickly?
Yeah, just for brothers, quickly. I'm late. Like I'm badly late.
Sorry.
Quick step.